This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the second day of June 2011, and I am joined on the line once again today by our old friend Adrian Salbucci of the Second Republic Project, and listeners might remember him from our recent interview, which was also featured on the podcast about the Second Republic Project and the Second Republic movement. So Adrian Salbucci, it is great to have you back on the program. Thank you for taking the time to join us once again.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me on, James.
All right, excellent. Well, it's good to have you here. And I wanted to have you on today to talk about an issue that recently came up with some of the correspondents with the Corbett Report, who were checking out your YouTube channel in the wake of our recent interview and came across some information that I think other people might have come across. And I wanted to talk about what they found, because basically, and I'll preface this by saying that that some people found that one of the YouTube channels that you were subscribed to is called the Lindgren, and is archival footage of various speeches by various members of the Nazi Party. And the actual emblem of this channel is the swastika and the Nazi flag, which obviously is quite offensive to some people. And I understand that it's absolutely offensive to me as well. And one of the people that are listed in your favorite authors on your YouTube channel was also Miguel Serrano, who, among other things, is obviously a Chilean poet, but among other things is also known for some works regarding Hitler as an avatar and a godlike being and things like this. So there was the impression among some that the question was worth asking whether you subscribed to a Nazi ideology, which was not something that I really suspected, but I think it's a good question to ask anyway, to find out more about the Second Republic and where it does stand, and just clarifying my own stance that obviously I'm anti-fascist to the core, I'm anti-Nazi to the core, I'm anti-collectivist to the core, I'm anti-communist to the core, and I stand for human liberty and freedom, so I obviously don't stand with those in the neo-Nazi movement or other movements like that. I don't think it's something that needs to be said, even. It's so obvious, but I need to make sure that everyone understands that on my own site, and I want to ask about your side of things and let you talk about it in your own words. So tell us about this and what you think of these observations.
Well, these are all, I found them, they surprised me at first, but then, you know, when I started exchanging emails with you and I started looking at and looking over what we had been discussing, I could understand the fact that some people maybe had those misgivings. So let's go one step at a time. First of all, I think that in here, I think you and I are in full agreement. If any of the present or past ideologies you and I thought are a solution to man, then we would either be with the Communist Party or with the Fascist Party or with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or some party somewhere in the world, and we're not. If we are trying to do what we're doing, you're doing it from a very, very important, intense, and extremely informative stance through your reports. And in my case, I'm even doing it promoting a specific, what we consider to be a whole new way of approaching things, a whole new ideology, so to speak, which we call Second Republic, and that you so graciously allowed me to already mention on your program, and that, you know, we'd like to, as we move forward, even fill in more of the details, which is, I consider, something totally new. As I say, if one of the ideologies of the past in the 20th century, even not in the present ones, were to be valid, well, we wouldn't be proposing something. We would be telling everybody, hey, come join the, I don't know, the Communist or the Nazi or whatever party. So that let it be said as that. This is something totally new. And I personally, and I say this very forcefully, am not aligned with any of the past ideologies of any sort. However, now, secondly, I'm 58 and I'm very bad with computers. And a lot of the stuff on my site is not actually run by me, but a lot of people put their little hands into that because I have some of my kids after helping me out, and I have an assistant. So both my YouTube channel, our website is, I don't even touch that. I have no idea how to modify a website. That is done by other colleagues and so forth. So I say this because different hands go into different things. Now, that being said, there's a reason why I mentioned that. I study very, very deeply for a long time different aspects of of the present history or the recent history of mankind. And from the Argentinian point of view, and I'll get to that in a moment, what happened during World War II is of prime importance. I think we will all agree, irrespective of what anybody's stance is, that World War II was probably the watershed war in the history of mankind, at least in the modern history of mankind. I mean, the world would have either gone one way or another. It went the way it went. So one of the things that I try to do, and I do it with extreme, I would even say ferocious independence of mind, is to find out what really happened. So when you all of a sudden have not just a historical stance of what were the roots of World War II, but also how it came about and how it developed and the consequences of World War II, when you only have one stance, and just one stance, through books, documentaries, academic reports, films, a lot of very high power public films and so forth regarding what took or did not take place in that span of time in the 30s and the 40s, especially in the 40s, I sort of say, well, I'd like to hear another story. I'd like to hear the other side of things. And in this particular website called the Lindgren or something like that, I had no idea who they are, but it's the first time, and this was brought to me by a friend, it was remarked to me by a friend, it's the first time I found completely unedited versions of speeches, I would say policy speeches, given by people from the Third Reich, from Germany, from Nazi Germany, being in the 30s and the 40s. And I found some of them to be very interesting in the sense that they explain what was really happening in Germany in the 30s. Let's not forget that it's very easy to see things with hindsight and say, okay, these guys were, I don't know, we're all crazy, whatever. But you have to say, okay, what is it? What was the message that was being given by the German leadership in the 30s that made it so, so attractive to the German people and even to the other peoples in Europe? Because let's not forget that contrary to Winston Churchill, who was not voted into power, or to Joseph Stalin, who was not voted into power, Hitler was voted into power, and so was Mussolini. So what is it that they, what was in the message that these guys gave? And what was their explanation of what was happening to their respective countries that made it so attractive? Now, I was never able, because this is part of the, I think, the trap of the post-World War II era, there is just not the sufficient kind of information and data, because it's all been sort of blacked out in a way, in a sense. Since they lost the war, that's it. They have no right for just about anything. And I found this site to be particularly interesting, amongst other things, because it even deals with some of the economic stuff, or it refers to some of the economic stuff that they were proposing at the time. So I figured it's part of my revisionist investigation, and I just started looking at it exclusively to have that alternative source of information. Now, yeah, you are right. Their logo is a swastika flag. Well, you know, that's their stuff. I have no idea why I wouldn't use it. They decide to use it. Well, okay, they are in a way justified. Their attitude is to justify what was said at the time, but I couldn't give a damn about that. I was just trying to see, and I still am trying to see, and I will continue trying to see what was the original documentation. They can't falsify it because the speeches are there and they're translated, and I speak quite a bit of German myself, so I can tell if they're doing anything that is not proper in that. And as I say, it's a flag. It was the official flag of a specific sovereign country during 12 years. You may jump and say, oh, that's horrible. A lot of people down here, when they see the American Star-Spangled Banner, they feel a lot of misgivings. Argentinians in general, when they see the American flag or the British flag, are not exactly, let's say, awed by it, and they don't take a great liking towards it. But as I say, flags can become symbols, and we have to be careful not to jump to conclusions or to close our eyes just because somebody uses a symbol we don't like. I'm sure if you show the Palestinians the flag of the state of Israel, they probably feel as bad as if you show a Jew a swastika flag.
Agreed, and I think it is absolutely ridiculous to hold a researcher accountable for the fact that he's using information from an historical perspective like that. And situating that in my own context, I mean, personally, I used to have a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf, and that certainly did not make me a Nazi. It made me someone who was interested in reading about what the Nazis were saying. And so, I mean, research of what people were saying is completely different than subscribing to an ideology. So it is the type of thing that is more about optics than about ideology. So let's talk more about ideology. And personally, this is something that I've been thinking about quite a bit and trying to put into the podcast more and more is the grounding ideology behind the politics that we're living in and those that we are attempting to create. And one of the things that I've been particularly thinking about recently is really the reasons, the roots, the foundation of government at all. And I think from my own perspective, I'm in a way trying to justify why we have government at all, right? Why anything rather than anarchism. And I'm perhaps leaning towards minarchism as the alternative. But how about from your own perspective, what is your political ideology and what do you see as the basis for the creation of government?
Yeah, careful how you say that, because you're going to be branded an anarchist. And from then, someone's going to say, and he's probably a communist too. No, I take your point very, very, very clearly. I'm speaking from Argentina. I think your listeners know this and your viewers know this, but I just thought it's a good idea to remind. This is the land where Juan Domingo Perón and Evita were born and actually governed this country for 10 years. Now, we had, and this is, I think, it goes straight into what you're mentioning. Perón used to have, he took what he created, I think he actually created the ideology that he called the third position. Now, Perón came into power in 1945, and he was illegally ousted from power by a military coup supported by the United States and Britain 10 years later in 1955. And I think he was ousted, amongst many other things, because he insisted on maintaining an absolutely independent ideology of what at that time the bipolar world, the United States and its allies on one side, in other words, the free world, democracy, et cetera, and on the other side, we had the workers' paradise, the Soviet Union with its captive countries and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. And Perón would say, we don't want to have one or the other. As a matter of fact, he had a very good way of conveying very complex terms to people, even with a lot of emotional charge behind it. And I remember that when a lot of these mass meetings were made in the public squares, one of the rallying slogans, it would translate, it runs in Spanish, but it would translate as follows. We're not with the Yankees, we're not with the commies, we are just Peronists. Which is a very primitive way of saying, we're not with the United States, we're not with Britain, we're doing our own thing. And I think definitely Perón was chastised because he was punished for doing that. And after he was ousted, first they tried to destroy Peronism physically, with physical violence. I mean, there were a lot of much persecution through several military coups that always persecuted the Peronists. But Peronism still survived. So what they ended up doing in the 90s and today, in the year 2011, is they infiltrated and destroyed it, first from the right, with the liberal policies of former President Menem, and now from the left with the hideous policies of socialists like the Kirchners. And you know, there was a very nice documentary movie from 1982 on Evita Perón, who's very popular. You know, you had the opera and everything, you had the movie. And the song's lyrics says, and again, I'm going to read this because it's very important. It doesn't rhyme, but it does rhyme in Spanish. It says, if history is written by the victors in war, that means that there must be another history, the true and real history. Let they who dare to hear listen. In other words, part of the booty that a winning faction gets is the right to write history as they feel fit. And that happened in 1945 when Germany fell. And it is the first example in human history where a powerful state completely collapses and falls into the hands of its worst enemies. So they took all the documentation back to Moscow, back to London, back to Paris, and back to New York, and then they started writing the history of what really happened. I'm sure that if they had all the secrets, the worst, the most terrible secrets of Germany right in front of them. I would like to know what history we would be writing if every secret of Great Britain and America were to fall into your hands or my hands. We would be writing a very, very nasty history of America, and I think we could demonize them very, very easily. Well, something like that happened down here in Argentina. And the third position, and I want to go straight into what you were asking, Perón's third position, which was later called the non-aligned countries, and you had a lot of other countries coming into that, was basically that we should heed neither to liberal capitalism nor to socialism, where everything is in the hands of the state. And his basic idea, and that's what I've tried, I'll say this very openly, very, very, very openly, Second Republic is basically what I feel that this country learned from Perón's ideology, but applied to the 21st century and applied on a more general basis and not just for one country. Perón died in 1974. It was a totally different world than it is today. And when I give conferences down here, I say, hey, with all the stuff that Perón wrote and all the things that he said, let's try to imagine what he would be saying if he could come back from the dead and he were here now today. And, you know, you say, okay, these were his basic ideas, but they were very dynamic. He definitely wouldn't be applying them the way he did in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s or the 70s. He would be applying it in a different way. And the conclusion I reach is that basically, government is not there to run your life. The purpose, and that is pillar number one of Second Republic, the main, absolute, inalienable, and unavoidable purpose of the nation state is to promote the common good of the majority of the people within the borders of a country. Let's simplify this and let's forget about globalization for a second. Let's think about, I don't know, Japan or Canada. The main function, and when they don't do this, the government should be ousted. The main function of the government of the state of Canada or the state of Japan is to promote the common good of the Canadians or the Japanese, and at the same time defend Canada or Japan against perils coming from outside, from inside, or from above, because nowadays it's the worst perils come from above. So. If you don't have a nation state, if you just allow what happened to Argentina, liberal ideology to say you don't need the nation state, you have to reform the state, you don't really even need laws defending anything, just sell everything off. You don't need state companies, sell everything off. You sell everything off, you change true physical assets for just little numbers money, and then they find a way to rechannel all that money to pay the bankers. So when you lose the capacity to have a nation state, you are really vulnerable. For example, today Argentina, on a military basis, is absolutely unarmed, which in a way is okay because, I mean, we had so much trouble with our military, who have been our own worst enemy, that rather than have really bad military institutions, you might as well have none. However, any self-respecting country knows that if it is confronted by perils from outside, the last bastion, the last line of defense of its own sovereignty are its armed forces. And that is the lesson that time and again Britain, America, France, Germany, just about every country has given us. Because, well, that can go completely overboard. America and Britain today have gone completely overboard. Instead of having armed forces for their defense, they have armed forces for offensive purposes. And that is the world's foremost problem nowadays. America has completely run amok. They've gone ballistic. And they invade just about anybody that they don't like. So definitely, when the sovereign nation state overdoes it, it can really go completely berserk. So what we're saying is, let's put the state back to what it should be doing. And that, Jim, and I'll round this off, has a lot to do with the fact that most people cannot differentiate between the nation state, which is a set of institutions, and government. So the problem is not with the nation state. In America, the problem is not the Constitution. They have a wonderful Constitution. The problem is not America's nation state. Maybe a lot of laws are wrong, but you can easily write the laws to make sure that they are all constitutional. The problem is government. It's the people, the flesh and blood, that become presidents, governors, senators, representatives, and so forth, and mayors of cities, and so forth. They are the ones that do all that foul everything up. And I'm sure it's the same in Japan, the same in Canada, and the same in Argentina. So what we have to look at is not so much say, I'm going to reform the state, I'm going to do away with the state, but rather let's look at the mechanisms whereby normal, unknown citizens rise to become president, prime minister, governor, minister, senator, representative, or whatever, because there lies the problem. The mechanism, and that comes to the other pillars of Second Republic, are totally dependent on money power. So today's money power, if they were given the choice, and they have taken the choice, what's the best way to control a country? The answer is obvious, through, quote, democracy, unquote. Because the other method is through military invasion, but that looks bad on the 6 o'clock news. It's very expensive. It kills our own boys, and then we have to explain that to the families. Whilst if I can control a country like Argentina by just paying for the right politicians to be in the right places of power, piece of cake, they do the work for me.
I see where you're coming from, but I think to stress the difference between the nation state, the institutions, and the government, and to say that the government has gone wrong and that's what wherein the problem lies, I think it to me the obvious solution is to take away the powers that centralized control over a national economy or a national legal system or what have you, to take away those powers from those centralized positions whereby they can be corrupted. Because it seems to me that it's the centralized governmental institutions that empower a central bank in order to take over an economy and to make the subsequent pariah banks underneath it possible, or it's the big stick of the government that makes it possible for corporations to come together to wield their power. And it's obviously not an easy problem to parse, but to me it seems that the more of that power we can take away from centralized control, the better it will be for the people who are trying to wield control over their own lives as opposed to the government.
You're probably going to laugh at what I'm about to say, because you probably figure this guy's nuts, but I fully, totally, and completely agree with you. But I'll tell you where I think maybe the focus point differs. The second chapter of my book, The Coming World Government, is called Power. Whence does it come from? Who has it? Where is it going? Because what I say basically there, and that is embedded into Second Republic, is that we have to understand that today's present world system is not guided or governed by laws, international law, a good economy, better distribution. Today's world is governed by power, and power has a rule of iron that says those who have power use it to promote their interests and objectives, and those who do not have power have no choice but to suffer the consequences of those actions taken by those people that do have power to promote their objectives and interests. What does this mean? That today's problem is a problem of power. The Greek historian Thucydides used to say, there can only be justice in a conflict when the two parties have more or less similar power. As soon as one side has far more power than the other, there is no more justice, because the guy having more power is going to impose his will on the weaker side. So what is today's problem? The problem today is that power, which is the ability to do certain things, and at the same time the ability to block certain other things that you don't like from being done, that power is no longer focused on the nation state. It has migrated into a private sphere above all nation state. Call it the banking cartel, the Fortune 500, the mainstream media, probably all of them together under a massive long-term planning exercise guided by think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral, the Bilderbergs, etc. What does that mean? That the great privatization that the world has undergone in the last 30 or 40 years is the privatization of power. And from a privatized power stance, they say, okay, we run the financial system, we run the banks, we run the industrial complexes, we run the universities, the key universities, we run them, we tell them what to teach, we naturally run the mainstream media, and we also run the nation states, because we decide who's going to be in the White House, who's going to be in 10 Downing Street, or in the Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires. So we've got all the power, and we're going to run the banking system in this way. We're going to run the financial system by defining money in this other way. We're going to run the political system, the nation state, by saying, oh, you have to have democracy, and we define that, like Hillary Clinton said just before she went to Egypt. We want to make sure that the Egyptians have the kind of democracy that we want to see. She literally said that. The kind of democracies we want to see, of course, because it's the money, so it's democracy subordinated to money. So if you, on top of that, do away with the nation state, you're doing away with the only institution that was originally designed, doesn't mean that it's doing its job today, but that is originally designed to promote the common good of the majority and defend the national interest or the interest of the people or of an entire region. You know, when I say national interest, don't think in terms of war. Think in terms of saying, hey, hold on, there's a danger up in the horizon. If the guy who was on the Titanic had seen that bloody iceberg 6 or 7 miles before, he would have just told the helmsman, hey, guy, 2 degrees to starboard, and we would have never heard of the Titanic ever sinking. He saw it too late. He did not envision. He did his risk management incorrectly. He did not see a peril that was on the way. One of the functions of the nation state, it's a geopolitical function, is to say, hold on, if we ignore what's happening on the other side of the world, we're going to run into a lot of trouble. So we might as well start doing something about it. And the high-profile side of the national interest are the military. But today, with 20th century technology, and with people like you and me starting to communicate, and everybody realizing that the enemies of every peoples are not some other peoples across the border or across the other side of the world. Our real enemies are the elites in different countries. My enemy is not the American people or the British people. It's the elite running America and the elite running Britain. And even, I'll tell you one more, my own enemy here is the elite, the local elite running Argentina. So people have become very, very lucid, are increasingly aware, and they're starting to realize that we have to redefine what the national interest of Argentina or Canada or Britain or America really is. And that's starting to work. So the thing is, and here's my question to you, I defy you to identify any social institution invented by man that has the sole function of promoting the common good of the majority and defending the national interest. And when I say promoting the common good of the majority, and this is the last comment I want to make here, I include the following. Every time we talk about discrimination, we tend to think that discrimination, because we've been programmed to do this, is a large majority of people being nasty to a little group of people, either because they are a different color, or they speak a different language, or they believe in a different religion, or they walk with a limp. It's discrimination. A lot of people being bad to the little guys. And what we have to do is turn it around also, because discrimination, and we know a lot about this in Argentina, is when a tiny group of extremely powerful people discriminate against the vast majority. Every time we had a coup, a military coup here, or civilian military coup, the last one we had was particularly obnoxious in 1976, and they got rid of the third Peronist government. Every time we've had a coup, the way to interpret it is a small minority, maybe 50, 60,000 people, who had the monopoly over the military weapons, and they had the monopoly of the economy, they discriminated against the other 40 million Argentinians. So one of the functions of this political institution is to ensure that never, ever should a minority wield a power which might be legal but illegitimate and discriminate against the vast majority. Because that's what's happening to just about every country in the world today. A tiny minority, which is not even in the country, it's above the country, is discriminating against all of us. But they wield a lot of power, and they can do things whether you like them or not. They'll let you kick and scream and bite and let off steam, but they'll say, okay, you finished, we're going to do what I say anyway. That's power.
But I would question the idea that nation states are instituted in order to promote the common good of the majority, because to me that sounds like utilitarianism, and to me that has always been a myth that's been used by the dominant minority in order to justify the creation of these tyrannies. Tyranny never comes seldom comes of people coming in your face and saying, I'm going to set up a tyranny and you must do what I say. It's almost always comes in the form of, well, it's for the common good of the majority and you can't be against that, right? And to me, that's just a false concept in and of itself. I'm not a utilitarian. I don't want to maximize some sort of, you know, generalized good for the maximum number of people, because ultimately, I think anything other than individuals is a philosophical construct. I think to say that there is some sort of mythical common good is in and of itself putting it in a way that presupposes the idea that we do need some sort of centralized control. And I'm not sure I agree with that.
You know, if for those folks who want to visit our website, www.secondrepublicproject.com, the very first button they'll find, the very first thing is like the introduction to what Second Republic is all about, is called personal sovereignty. Because we say, how can anybody talk about saying, hey, I want to liberate America or liberate Canada or liberate Argentina or liberate whatever your country is. I want to have a free country if you yourself are not previously a free individual. If you don't know how to think with your own mind, then you're just thinking with all the stuff, the pre-digested stuff you read in the New York Times or you watch on CNN or Fox News or whatever. So the first thing is definitely personal sovereignty. Now, when I say the common good, I am not thinking in economic terms, because very often defending the common good means perhaps going against the economy. It's just having your priorities right. I'll give it again an example of America and Britain. In order to defend what they thought was the national interest in different types of time, they made war at a tremendous economic loss, at a tremendous loss of life, because there was an objective, which I think they probably identified correctly. If we let Germany and Japan win this Second World War, then we're done for. So we have to do something to stop them. Is it economically viable? No. Do you have guaranteed success? No. Will a lot of our people die? Yes. And yet they did it anyway. Why? Because they had a political class. I'm not opening judgment on them. I'm just merely saying how it worked at that time, who saw that there was a greater peril that justified them going to war and everything. I'm not justifying. I'm just merely saying that that is what it was. Now, the thing is, and here, although I said at the beginning of our chat, a lot of people down here, when they see the American flag or the British flag, that sends jitters up their spine. And I was mentioning that because the German flag, no matter from what period, doesn't really send that many jitters up down the spines of many people, because Germany was never an enemy of Argentina, ever, 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 throughout the last 200 years. However, Britain and America have been systematically enemies of Argentina and the better part of Latin America. As you know, we fought a war, the Falkland Malvinas War in 1982, against the flag of Britain, supported by the flag of America. It was a short war, no big deal, but, you know, it's a different viewpoint that we have from here. Now, the Americans, however, and in this I admire them profoundly, they have a constitution, they have a Declaration of Independence, they have a Bill of Rights, which really, I think, sets the record, and add to that the Federalist Papers and all the documentation from those really, truly glorious years. And you figure, well, here's a blueprint of what the nation state pretty much should be doing, what it should be doing. Because if the nation state doesn't do it and it says, okay, individuals, I'm going to respect your individuality, everybody go and do your own thing, then you're going to have very powerful groups, the bankers, for example, who are going to say, ooh, look at this very wealthy country of Argentina with a lot of individualistic people who refuse to subordinate to government, each doing their thing. How nice, how easy to control them. So although I don't like centralized power either, especially when it is dictatorial and it tells you what to do and it pushes you around, and boy, have we suffered that down here in Argentina, how we have suffered that, and they're starting to suffer that in America. Although we don't like that, I figure, hang on a minute. We have to have some sort of instrument of common, coordinated, sequential, coherent, and consistent common action, because powerful minorities are doing a lot of common action, and so much so, and you know what your own enemy tells you is also always very important, that they themselves are telling you between the lines, one of the things that we need to control from our private power Olympus is the nation state. That's why we need to control the United States of America. We need to control the European Union. We need to control who's in government in Argentina. They invest a lot of money in that, a lot of effort, and a lot of side wars. So they themselves are recognizing how very important the nation state is. And they're saying it's either in the hands of the people and then we're doomed, or it's in our hands and then we do whatever we like. And they have done such wonderful, consistent, very intelligent engineering throughout the last century, at least, that they have seized control of all nation states. And one of the things that Second Republic says is that the first thing we have to understand is that the nation state has been hijacked so that today in America, in Argentina, in Britain, it acts as a colonial administration entity. So that they turn the nation state into a colonial administration entity, colonial to whom? To the global power elite. So we have the governments of just about every country doing exactly what they should be doing, miseducating the people. And if anything, and I'll close on this on this note, if anything, what is the best guarantee to ensure that the nation state is never hijacked either by the military, as we suffered, or by the bankers, as America is suffering, or by, I don't know, any ideology which is not geared on the common good, as all countries have suffered in throughout their history. The best antidote is for we the people to be educated, to know what it's all about, to listen to Jim Corbett, who will tell you, listen, this is the way the world really works, not the way the New York Times tell you. That's why they invest so much money in ensuring that CBS, NBC, ABC, the BBC, Fox News, and all these mainstream media will give a false picture, and they will hope and pray that the Jim Corbetts of this world or the Adrian Salbucci's of this world will just continue having a tiny voice. So we can even say, ah, it's a tiny voice, they pose no peril, and we're so democratic, we'll even let them talk. But mark my words, if you or I tomorrow were to become very powerful voices, to really be able to leverage and influence world public opinion, you and I, you know this very well, we're going to have to take some measures because we can get into a lot of trouble very quickly.
Very true. Well, I can't dispute that last point, especially the point that education really is the key and the crux of what we need to really start to combat this, because if we can't understand our situation, then what hope do we have? And I I'm not sure I subscribe to the ideas that you're promulgating, but I think you put them very well, and it is an important debate, and it's certainly not one that I claim to have the final answer on, or that I'm completely right. But I am wary of the various justifications for centralization of control. And again, I'm not saying that I have all of the answers, but it's something that I'm continuing to think about, and I think the Second Republic Project is one way for people to take a look at this. So tell people again about the Second Republic and its website and how people can find out more information about your ideology and what you're promoting.
Absolutely. It's www.secondrepublicproject.com. We also have, we're starting to set up specific sites for each country, because basically the five pillars of Second Republic, which are the sovereign nation state that we've been discussing with you, and only from a sovereign nation state, which is the first pillar, do we believe that we will be able to move on to the second pillar, which is a sovereign currency that I think we discussed with you a couple of weeks back when we were talking on your show on how money should be run. If you do not have a sovereign nation state, you will never be able to ensure that public money, dollars, yens, euros, pesos, or whatever, is put in the proper proportion, in the proper quantity to serve the real economy, instead of being hijacked by the banksters who will legally be able to create money out of nothing because they ensure that the laws are in place that will allow them to do that. We've seen that in the United States, and that is the tragedy of the ongoing financial meltdown, that they got rid of Glass-Steagall, for example, which was a much more intelligent law from the 1930s. So that would be the second pillar. The third pillar is to do away with debt, the debt-based economic system. The fourth pillar, and this we've also been discussing, would be to liberate the republican institutions from subservience to money. And the fifth pillar, which is a little bit more complex, and maybe we can address it some other day if you like, is to return to traditional values, because we figure that in a way what the global power elite have done is they have put our values topsy-turvy. I'm not talking about anything goody-goody. I'm just saying, you know, finance should be subordinated to the real economy. The real economy should be subordinated to a political plan which can only emanate from a truly sovereign nation state. That political plan has to respect local culture, values, traditions, everything you want, history, everything you want to add to that. And the problem we have today is that that's been put on its head. And the last comment I would say that at least is one of the key points of Second Republic is that if anybody were to ask us, well, what is the global power elite's main instrument of power, since we talk a lot about power, I would say that it's not the military, although that has a lot of impact. It's not their money, which they can even print, but that, you know, that also is not their secret weapon. It's not even the media. Their secret weapon is that they do long-term planning and long-term thinking. All their elites, all their Ivy League universities, Princeton, Yale, MIT, Harvard, are there to educate their own people into long-term thinking. And long-term thinking means that you start something today and you might see the results 20, 30, maybe two generations down the road, which is why they often use symbols, because they need to communicate to future generations who will finish up what these guys are starting now. They are planning 50, 60, 100 years. And at the same time, the 99.9% of the rest of us are permanently educated into short-term thinking. get a life, get a career, become a doctor, become an architect, get an engineer, earn a lot of money, retire, play golf, and then when you get sick, game over, and that's it. You're in the waste bin of social history. So when you are a short-term thinker, you do not have the mental instruments, the intellectual instruments, to be able to identify and understand the steps of long-term action that are happening right in front of your nose. We just don't see them. So they can operate out in the open without hiding anything. There's no conspiracy theory here or anything of that sort. They just do their thing, knowing that 99% of the people will not even understand what's unfolding in front of their own faces. So what we're saying is, understand the world, and when you do, these five pillars are a template that can be used by just about any country. And Second Republic is already setting up specific country sites. We're doing one for Canada. We're doing one for Costa Rica. We already have one up and running for Argentina. We're going to be starting one for Uruguay. Because every country, when they start to fill in the blanks of what each of these pillars means, they realize that they have different local situations. And again, whilst democracy is standardized for everybody, that's why Hillary wants to make sure that Egypt has the kind of democracy she wants to see. And communism was standard for everybody. You got to be a Marxist-Leninist. I don't care if you live in the Ukraine, in China, or in Cuba. Our stance is let every country do their own thing in their own style, in their own way, and based on their own local problems and history. So if the third pillar, rejected the debt-based system for Argentina, means investigating our illegal foreign debt created by the military. For America, it would probably mean audit the Fed or do away with the Fed.
All right. Well, a lot of information to go through, as always, and I think you make some very good points there, especially about generational planning, because I think the systems that we're opposing have been demonstrably the result of generations of very careful and methodical planning. So I think it would be naive of us to think that we can overturn those systems overnight, and that it won't require a lot of work on our side. So again, there's a lot of things to think about, and although I don't necessarily agree with all of the things that you're saying, I think they are worth taking on board, and people really need to start having these kinds of discussions on a wider basis. And so I hope they will check into the Second Republic Project website and find out more. All right, Adrian Salbucci, it's great to have you on, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
Absolutely. Can I just make one very, very last quick comment?
Please do.
I have a personal friend who's part of our team who says, wherever two intelligent people start to talk, they never agree 100% on anything. Only idiots agree 100% on everything. So when there are two intelligent people, it's natural, it's good that we should disagree, and that's called debate. That's what debate is all about. And I'm learning something new every day, and I know you're learning something new every day. So the debate basis, I think, is fundamental, because nobody owns the truth in this. We're all sort of, you know, trying to find our way and groping in the dark very often. And the second point is that, although I know that most people writing in and making comments on websites and on YouTube channels and everything prefer to hide behind anonymity, which is something that, you know, it's sort of a phenomenon of the present day and age. Anybody that asks any question or poses any question regarding what we're trying to do or anything, the things I've discussed, that you, James, feel that it would be good for me to answer, you need only forward it to me, and I'll be more than happy, even if I don't know who's at the other end of the line, to make whatever clarifications and so forth are necessary. We're trying to create something new, and as I say, we have to learn from the past, and every time I see a good idea, I don't care where it came from, if the idea is good and it works and it's worth investigating, let's investigate it, so that at least it will promote a better understanding of where we stand today, and if we know exactly where we stand today, we can better plan for the future.
Well, that's a very good point, and an important one to make, because, and let me add as a final point, that I've noticed as a growing part of the internet culture that we're finding ourselves immersed in as we're doing a lot of this work online, I see a growing movement towards having people either agree 100% with everything that someone says or dismiss them completely. And I think there must be some sort of way of talking with people with whom we disagree and finding middle ground and finding other things that we can agree on and points that where we can work together. Because if we have to completely and utterly reject anyone with whom we have any slight disagreement, then I think we would have to ultimately end up rejecting everyone on Earth. And I think that's probably not a healthy way to proceed. So I'm certainly open to talking to people with whom I disagree and talking about those disagreements. And I think you're right. If we can do that, then we have some hope towards constructing a better future.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me on the show, James.
All right. Thank you.